gave his impassioned arguments a ring of sincerity that was largely unfamiliar at court. "He may be mad," thought Saint-Angel, "but he is honest. Honest and clever." "He never raises his voice," noted Saint-Angel. "He never lectures, never harangues. Instead, he speaks as if this were a conversation between a brother and sister. He is always respectful, but also intimate. He speaks with manly strength, yet never sounds as if he thinks her his inferior in matters of thought or understanding." A fatal mistake which many men had made over the years when speaking to Isabella. At long last, the interview ended. Isabella, always careful, promised nothing, but Saint-Angel could see how her eyes shone. "We will speak again," she said. "I think not," thought Saint-Angel. "I think Ferdinand will want to keep direct contact between his wife and this Genovese to a minimum. But she will not forget him, and even though at this moment the treasury can afford nothing beyond the war, if Columbus is patient enough and does nothing stupid, I think Isabella will find a way to give him a chance." A chance for what? To die at sea? Lost with three caravels and all their crews? Starving or dying of thirst or broken up in some storm or swallowed up in a maelstrom? Columbus was dismissed. Isabella, weary but happy, sank back in her throne, then beckoned to Quintanilla and Cardinal Mendoza, both of whom had also waited through the interview. To Saint-Angel's surprise, she also beckoned to him. "What do you think of this man?" she asked. Quintanilla, always the first to speak and the last to have anything valuable to say, merely shrugged. "Who can tell whether his plan has merit?" Cardinal Mendoza, the man that some called the Third King, smiled. "He speaks well, Your Majesty, and he has sailed with the Portuguese and met with their king," he said. "But it will take much examination before we know whether his ideas have merit. I think his idea of the distance between Spain and Cathay, sailing west, is grossly wrong." Then she looked at Saint-Angel. This terrified him. He had not won his position of trust because he spoke up in the presence of others. He was not a speaker. Rather, he acted. The king trusted him because when he promised he could raise a sum of money, he produced it. When he promised they could afford to carry out a campaign, the funds were there. "What do I know of such matters, Your Majesty?" he asked. "Sailing west. What do I know of that?" "What will you tell my husband?" she asked. Teasingly, for of course he was an open observer, not a spy. "That Columbus's plan is not as expensive as a siege, but more expensive than anything we can afford at present." She turned to Quintanilla. "And can Castile not afford it either?" "At present, Your Majesty," said Quintanilla, "it would be difficult. Not impossible, but if it failed it would make Castile look foolish in the eyes of others." No need to say that the others he referred to were Ferdinand and his advisers. Saint-Angel knew that Isabella was always careful to retain the respect of her husband and the men he listened to, for if she gained a reputation for foolishness, it would be an easy matter for him to step in and take over more and more of her power in Castile with little resistance from the Castilian lords. Only her reputation for manlike wisdom allowed her to remain a strong rallying point for the Castilians, which in turn gave her a measure of independence from her husband. "And yet," she said, "why did God make us queen, if not to bring his children to the cross?" Cardinal Mendoza nodded. "If his ideas have merit, then pursuing them would be worth any sacrifice, Your Majesty," he said. "So let us keep him here with the court, so he can be examined, so his ideas can be discussed and compared to the knowledge we have from the ancients. There's no hurry, I think. Cathay will still be there in a month or two, or a year. Isabella thought for a few moments. The man has no estate, she said. If we keep him here, then we must attach him to the court. She looked at Quintanilla. He must be allowed to live as a gentleman. He nodded. I already gave him a small sum to keep him while he waited for this audience. 15,000 maravedis out of my own purse, said the queen. That is for the year, your majesty? If it takes more than a year, she said, we'll speak of this again. She waved her hand and looked away. Quintanilla left. Cardinal Mendoza also excused himself and took his leave. Saint Angel turned to go, but she called him back. Luis, she said. Your majesty. She waited until Cardinal Mendoza had gone. How extraordinary that Cardinal Mendoza chose to listen to all that Columbus had to say. He's a remarkable man, said Saint Angel. Which? Columbus or Mendoza? Since Saint Angel wasn't sure himself, he had no ready answer. You heard him, Luis Saint Angel, and you are a hard-headed man. What do you think of him? I believe him to be an honest man, said Saint Angel. Beyond that, who can know? Oceans and sailing vessels and kingdoms of the East. I know nothing of that. But you do know how to judge whether a man is honest. He's not here to steal from the royal coffers, said Saint Angel. And he meant every word that he said to you today. Of that I'm certain, Your Majesty. I am too, said the Queen. I hope he is able to make his case to the scholars. Saint Angel nodded. And then, against his better judgment, he added a rather daring comment. Scholars don't know everything, Your Majesty. She raised her eyebrows. Then she smiled. He won you over too, did he? Saint Angel blushed. As I said, I think him an honest man. Honest men don't know everything either, she said. In my line of work, Your Majesty, I have come to think of honest men as a precious rarity, while scholars are rather thick on the ground. And is that what you will tell my husband? Your husband, he said carefully, will not ask me the same questions that you asked. Then he will end up knowing less than he should know, don't you think? It was as close as Queen Isabella could come to openly admitting the rivalry between the two crowns of Spain, despite the careful harmony of their marriage. It would not do for Saint Angel to commit himself on such a dangerous question. I cannot begin to guess what sovereigns should know. Neither can I, said the Queen softly. She looked away, a sort of melancholy drifting across her face. It won't do for me to see him too often, she murmured. Then, as if remembering Saint Angel was there, she waved him off. He left at once, but her words lingered. It won't do for me to see him too often. So, Columbus had struck deeper than he knew. Well, that was something the king didn't need to hear about. No reason to tell the king something that would lead to the poor Genovese dying on some dark night with a dirk between his ribs. Saint Angel would tell King Ferdinand only what King Ferdinand would ask. Did Columbus's idea seem worth the cost? And to that, Saint Angel would answer honestly that at present it was more than the crown could afford, but at some later date, with the war successfully concluded, it might be both feasible and desirable, if it were judged to have any chance at all of success. And in the meantime, there was no need to worry about the queen's last remark. She was a Christian woman and a clever queen. She would not jeopardize her place in eternity or on the throne for the sake of some brief yearning for this white-haired Genovese. Nor did Columbus seem such a fool as to seek that dangerous avenue of preferment. Yet Saint Angel wondered if, in the back of Columbus's mind, there might not be some small hope of winning more than the mere approval of the queen. Well, what would it matter? It would come to nothing. If Saint Angel was any judge of men, he was certain that Cardinal Mendoza had left the court tonight determined to see to it that Columbus's examination would be hellish. The poor man's arguments would end up in shreds. After the scholars were through with him, he would no doubt slink away from Cordoba in shame. Too bad, thought Saint Angel. He made such an excellent start. And then he thought, I want him to succeed. I want him to have his ships and make his voyage. What has he done to me? Why should I care? Columbus has seduced me as surely as he seduced the queen. He shuddered at his own fragility. He had thought he was a stronger man than that.
It was obvious to Hunapu from the beginning that Kamal was annoyed at having to waste time listening to this unknown child from Mexico. He was cold and impatient. But Tagiri and Hassan were pleasant enough, and when Hunapu looked at Diko, he could see that she was perfectly at ease, and her smile was warm and encouraging. Perhaps Kamal was always like this. Well, no matter, thought Hunapu. What mattered was the truth. And Hunapu had that, or at least more of it than anyone else had put together yet about these matters. It took an hour to get through all that he had shown to Diko in half that time, mostly because Kamal kept interrupting at first, challenging Hunapu's statements. But as time went on, as it became clear that all of Kamal's challenges were easily dealt with, using evidence that Hunapu had already intended to include a bit later in his presentation, the hostility began to slacken, and he was allowed to proceed with fewer questions. Now he had reached the end of the things that Diko had seen, and as if to signal that fact, she pulled her chair closer to the true sight viewing area. The others who had watched yesterday also grew more attentive. I have shown you that the Tarascans had the technology to establish a more dominant empire than the Mexica, and the Tlaxcalans were reaching for that technology. Their struggle for survival had made them more willing to embrace novelty, which we saw a bit later, of course, when they made alliance with Cortes. But this wasn't all. The Zapotecs of the northern coast of the Isthmus of Tehuantepec were also developing a new technology. The Trusite, too, at once began displaying shipbuilders at work. Hunapu showed them the standard ocean-going canoa of the Tainos and Caribs of the islands to the east. Then the differences in the new ships that the Zapotecs were building. Rudders, he said, and they could see that the tiller was indeed being transformed into the more efficient steering device. And now, he said, look how they're making the ships larger. Sure enough, the Zapotecs were reaching for a greater carrying capacity than would ever be possible in a dugout canoe made from a single tree. At first it consisted of wide decks straddling the sides of the canoe and reaching beyond, but this became unwieldy, making the boat too likely to tip. A better solution was to shape a second tree into a vertical extension of the sides of the canoe, lashed to the hull by the use of holes bored into the sides. To make it watertight, they smeared the surfaces with sap before they put them together, making a glue-like bond when it was lashed tight. Clever, said Kamal. It doubles the carrying capacity of the ships, but it slows them down, too. They tend to wallow in the water. What matters, though, is that they've learned to join wood and make it watertight. Single-tree construction is over. It's just a matter of time before the original one-tree canoe becomes the keel, and planks are used to make a much wider, shallower hull. A matter of time, said Kamal, but you don't actually see any being made. What they lack is adequate tools, said Hunapu. When Tlaxcala takes over the Aztec Empire, the bronze of the Tarascans will come to the Zapotecs, and they'll be able to make boards more efficiently and with more reliably smooth surfaces. The point is that when they make any innovation, it spreads quickly. And the Zapotecs are also under pressure from the Aztecs. They have to find sources of supply because the Mexican armies have forced them from their fields. In this swampy land, farming is always precarious. So, look where they're sailing. He showed them the clumsy, wallowing Zapotec ships carrying large cargoes from Veracruz and the Yucatan. Slow as these ships are, they carry enough cargo on each trip to make the voyages profitable. They're far enough up the coast of Veracruz now to be in contact with the Tlaxcalans and the Tarascans. And here, again the view changed. This is the island of Hispaniola. And look who's coming to visit. Three Zapotecan ships slipped up to the shore. Unfortunately, said Hunapu, Columbus was already there. But if he hadn't been there, said Tico, it could have extended the reach of a Tlaxcalan empire out to the islands. Exactly, said Hunapu. There was already extensive contact between Mesoamerica and the Caribbean islands, said Kamal. Of course, said Hunapu. The Taino culture was actually an overlay by earlier raiders from the Yucatan. They brought the ball court with them, for instance, and established themselves as the ruling class. But they adopted the Arawak language and soon forgot their origins. And they certainly did not establish regular trade routes. Why should they? The boats didn't carry enough to make trade profitable. Only raiding was worth the effort. And the Caribs were the raiders, not the Taino. And since they came out of the southeastern Caribbean, Mesoamerica was even further out of reach. The Taino knew about Mesoamerica as a fabled land of gold and wealth and mighty gods. That's what they meant when they kept telling Columbus that the land of gold was to the west. But they had no regular contact. These Zapotecan ships would have changed all that, especially as the ships got bigger and better. It would have been the beginning of a sailing tradition that would have led to ships that could cross the Atlantic.
Very speculative, said Kamal.
Forgive me, said Diko, but isn't that what your entire project is? Speculation? Kamal glowered at her.
What matters, said Hunapu, anxious not to antagonize Kamal, is not the details. What matters is that the Zapotecs were innovating. They reached the islands with ships that could carry larger cargoes, and they were also a familiar sight to the Tlaxcalans along the coast of Veracruz. It's unthinkable that the Tlaxcalans would not have seized upon this new technology just as they reached for the bronze working of the Tarascans. It was an age of invention and innovation in Mesoamerica, and the only barrier was the ultra-conservative Mexican leadership. That was doomed. Everyone knows it. And it seems obvious to me from this evidence that the Tlaxcalans would have become the successor empire. And as the Persians far outstripped the empire of the Chaldeans, so also the innovative, politically sophisticated Tlaxcalan empire would have outreached the empire of the Mexica.
You've made that case very well, said Kamal. Hunapu almost allowed himself a sigh of relief. But you have claimed much more than that, haven't you? And for those claims you have no evidence.
Columbus's discovery erased all the other evidence, said Hunapu. But then, the intervention also erased Columbus's crusade to the east. I think we're on equal ground here.
Equally shaky, said Kamal.
Kamal is heading the speculative aspects of our research, said Tagiri, precisely because he is profoundly skeptical about it. He doesn't believe an accurate reconstruction is possible.
That thought had never occurred to Hunapu, that Kamal was predisposed to reject all speculations. He had assumed that his only task was to bring Kamal to consider another possible scenario. Not that he had to persuade him that it was possible to construct a scenario at all.
Diko seemed to sense his consternation.
Hunapu, she said, let's leave aside the issue of what can and can't be proved. You must have developed the rest of the story in your mind. let's regard it as likely that Tlaxcala has conquered and unified the whole of the old Mexica Empire, and that now it's running smoothly, with Zapotecan ships trading far and wide, and Tarascan bronze workers making weapons and tools for them. What then?
Her guidance helped him recover his confidence. Trying to convince the great Kamal against his will was too much to contemplate, talking about ideas he could do.
First, you have to remember, said Hunapu, that there was one problem of the Mexica that the Tlaxcalans had not overcome. As with the Mexica, the Tlaxcalan practice of wholesale sacrifice to their bloodthirsty god would have drained away the manpower they needed to feed their population.
So, how do you resolve it? Asked Kemal. You wouldn't have come here if you didn't have an answer.
I have a possibility, anyway. There's nothing in the evidence because Tlaxcala hadn't had to govern a real empire yet. But they couldn't have succeeded if they made the same mistake the Mexica made, slaughtering the able-bodied men of their subject population. So here's how I think they would have solved it. There's a hint of a doctrine among the priestly class that their warrior god, Kamaxtli, becomes especially thirsty for blood after he has exerted himself to give Tlaxcala a victory. The existence of this idea makes it possible for the Tlaxcalans to evolve the practice of only offering huge mass sacrifices after a military victory, because that's the only time that Kamaxtli is especially in need of blood. So if a city or nation or tribe willingly allies itself with Tlaxcala, submits to their overlordship, and allows the Tlaxcalan bureaucracy to administer their affairs, then instead of being sacrificed, their men are left to work the fields. Perhaps if they prove to be trustworthy, they can even join the Tlaxcalan army or fight alongside it. The mass sacrifices are only performed using captives from armies that resist. Aside from that, peacetime sacrifices in the Tlaxcalan Empire would stay at a tolerable level, the way they were before the Mexica arose to form the Aztec Empire in the first place.
It gives the surrounding nations a reward for surrendering, said Hassan, and a reason not to rebel.
Just the way so much of the Roman Empire didn't have to be conquered, said Hunapu. The Romans seemed so irresistible that kings of neighboring countries would make the Roman Senate their heir to their thrones, so that they could live as sovereigns until they died, and then their kingdoms would pass peacefully into the Roman system. It's the cheapest way to build an empire, and the best, since there's no war damage to the newly acquired lands.
So, said Kemal, if their god isn't bloodthirsty, except after victory, they become peaceful, and their god goes to sleep.
Well, that would be nice, said Hunapu, but part of their theology was that besides needing sacrifices after victory, Kamaxtli liked the blood. Kamaxtli liked war. So they could put off the huge sacrifices until they won a victory, but they would still keep looking for more fights that might lead to such a victory. Besides, the Tlaxcalans had the same social mobility system as the Mexica in their pre-Moctezuma days. The only way to rise within their society was either to make a lot of money or to prevail in battle, and making money was only possible for those who controlled trade. So there would have been constant pressure to start new wars with ever more remote neighbors.
I think it wouldn't have taken the bronze-wielding Tlaxcalans long to reach the natural boundaries of their new seafaring empire. The Caribbean islands to the east, the mountains of Colombia to the south, and the deserts to the north. Conquests beyond those boundaries would not have been cost-effective, either because there were no large concentrated populations to exploit economically or to offer as sacrifices, or because the resistance would have been too strong as they came in contact with the Incas.
So they turned to the empty Atlantic.
Unlikely, said Kemal.
I agree, said Hunapu. Left to themselves, I think they would never have turned eastward, or not for centuries.
But they weren't left to themselves. The Europeans came to them.
Well, then we're right back where we started, said Kemal. The superior European civilization discovers the backward Indies, and
not so backward now, said Diko.
Bronze blades against muskets?
scoffed Kamal.
Muskets weren't decisive, said Hunapu.
Everyone knows that. The Europeans simply couldn't come in large enough numbers for their superior weapons to overcome the numerical advantage of the Indies. Besides, there's something else to consider. The Europeans wouldn't have come straight to the heart of the Caribbean this time. The later discovery would almost certainly have come from the Portuguese. Several Portuguese ships landed on or sighted the coast of Brazil quite independently of Columbus as early as the late 1490s. But the land they saw was dry and barren, and it didn't lead to India the way the coast of Africa would. So their exploration, instead of having the urgency that Columbus brought to it, would have been occasional and desultory. It would have taken years before Portuguese ships would have entered the Caribbean. By then, the Tlaxcalan Empire would already be well established there. Now, instead of Europeans finding the sweet-natured Taino, they would meet the fierce and hungry Tlaxcalans, who would be getting frustrated by the fact that they weren't able to expand easily beyond their current borders around the Caribbean basin. What do the Tlaxcalans see? To them, the Europeans aren't gods from the east. To them, the Europeans are new victims that Camoxley has brought to them, showing them how to get back on the path to productive warfare. And those big European boats and muskets aren't just strange miracles. The Tlaxcalans, or their Tarascan or Zapotecan allies, would immediately start taking them apart. Probably they'd sacrifice enough of the sailors to persuade the ship's carpenter and the ship's smith to make a deal, and unlike the Mexica, the Tlaxcalans would keep them alive and learn from them. How long would it take them to have muskets of their own? Big-bottom ships. And in the meantime, the Europeans are hearing nothing at all about the Tlaxcalan Empire, because any ships that reach Caribbean waters are being captured, and their crews never get home. So the Tlaxcalans aren't independently developing technology anymore, said Tagiri. That's right. All they needed was to be advanced enough to understand the European technology when they encountered it, and to have an attitude that would allow them to exploit it. And that's what the interveners understood. They had to get Europeans to discover the New World before the Tlaxcalans came to power, back with the relatively incompetent, decadent Mexica. That does work, said Kamal thoughtfully. It does allow for a believable scenario. The Tlaxcalans build European-style ships and make European-style muskets, and then come to the shores of Europe fully prepared for a war whose purpose is to enlarge the empire and at the same time bring sacrifices to the temples of Camoxtli. I suppose the same pattern would apply in Europe, too. Any nation that resisted them would be slaughtered, while those that allied themselves to the Tlaxcalans would only have to endure a tolerable level of human sacrifice. I don't think it would be difficult to imagine Europe fragmenting over this. I don't think the Tlaxcalans would lack for allies, particularly if Europe had been weakened by a long and bloody crusade. To Hunapu, this sounded like victory. Kamal himself had completed the scenario for him. But it doesn't work anyway, said Kamal. Why not? Asked Tico. Smallpox, said Kamal. Bubonic plague, the common cold. That was the great killer of the Indies. For every Indie who died of overwork and slavery or from Spanish muskets and swords, 100 died of disease. Those plagues would still have come. Oh, yes, thought Hunapu. That was one of the biggest problems, and there's no way to find evidence for what I'm about to say. But we do know the way diseases work in human populations. The Europeans carried these diseases because they were such a large population, with lots of travel and trade and warfare, lots of contact between nations. So that as far as disease organisms were concerned, Europe was one vast cauldron in which they could cook, just like China and India, which also had indigenous diseases. In a large population like that, successful diseases are the ones that evolve so they kill slowly, and are not always fatal. That gives them time to spread, and leaves enough of the human population behind that it can recover and bring up a new, non-immune generation within a few years. These diseases eventually evolve into childhood epidemics, cycling around the large overall population pool, striking here, and then there, and then over there, and finally here again. When Columbus came, there was no region of the Americas that had such a large population pool. Travel was too slow, and the barriers were too great. There were a few indigenous diseases. Syphilis comes to mind. But that one was exceptionally slow to kill in the American context. Fast-moving plagues were impossible because they would spend themselves in one locality and run out of human hosts before they could get carried to a new locality. But that changes with the Tlaxcalan Empire. Zapotecan boats, said Dico. That's right. This empire is linked by ships carrying cargoes and passengers all around the Caribbean basin. Now plagues can travel swiftly enough to spread and become indigenous.
That still doesn't mean that a new plague won't be devastating, said Kamal. It just means that smallpox would travel faster and strike the whole empire almost at the same time.
Yes, said Hunapu. Just as bubonic plague devastated Europe in the 14th century, but there's a difference now. The plague will reach the Tlaxcala Empire from those earlier accidental Portuguese visitors, before the Europeans come in force. It sweeps through the empire with exactly as much devastation as it had in Europe. Smallpox, measles, they have their terrible effect. But not one nation in Europe fell because of these plagues. No empire collapsed, any more than Rome collapsed because of the plagues in their time. In fact, the plague has the effect of giving them more favorable population densities. With fewer mouths to feed, the Tlaxcalans can now produce a food surplus. And what if they interpret these plagues as a sign that Camoxtli wants them to go and win more captives for sacrifice? That might be the final spur to make them sail east. And now when they come, smallpox and measles and the common cold are already indigenous to the Tlaxcalans. They touch on European shores already immune to European diseases. But the Europeans have not been exposed to syphilis at all. And when syphilis first reached Europe in our history, it struck viciously, killing quickly. It only gradually settled down to be the slow killer it had been among the Indies. And who knows what other diseases might have developed among the Tlaxcalans as their empire grew. This time, I think the plagues would have worked the other way, against the Europeans and in favor of the Indies.
Possible, said Kamal. But it depends on so many suppositions. Any scenario we think of will depend on suppositions, said Tagiri, but this one has one unique virtue.
And what is that? Asked Kamal.
This one would have created a future terrible enough for the interveners to think it worthwhile to go back and erase their own time in order to eliminate the source of the disaster. Think of what it would have meant to human history if the powerful, technology-wielding civilization that swept the dominance over the whole world was one that believed in human sacrifice. If Mesoamerican cults of torture and slaughter had come to India and China and Africa and Persia, armed with rifles and linked by railroads, and tied together with a single, unified, powerful, and efficient bureaucracy the way the Romans were, added Dico. The internal dissensions of Europe went a long way toward making their overlordship weaker and more tolerable. Tagiri went on. It is not hard to imagine that the interveners, looking back, saw the Tlaxcalan conquest of Europe as the worst, most terrible disaster in the history of humanity. And then they saw Columbus's drive and ambition and personal charisma as the tool they could use to put a stop to it.
What does this mean, then? Said Hassan. Do we abandon our entire project because stopping Columbus would be worse than what he and those who came after him actually caused in our history?
Worse? Asked Tagiri.
Who is to say which is worse? What do you say, Kamal?
Kamal looked triumphant.
I say that if Huonapu is right, which we can't prove, though he makes a good case, we learn only one thing. Meddling with the past is useless because, as the interveners proved, the mess you make is little better than the mess you avoid.
Not so, said Hunapu. Everyone turned to look at him, and he realized that caught up in the discussion he had forgotten whom he was dealing with, that he was contradicting Kamal, and in front of Tagiri and Hassan, no less. He glanced over at Diko and saw that far from looking worried, she simply gazed at him with interest, waiting to hear what he would say, and he realized that this was how all of them were looking at him, except Kamal, and his scowl was probably not personal, it seemed to be his permanent expression. For the first time, Hunapu realized that he was being treated as an equal here, and they were not offended or contemptuous at his daring to speak. His voice was as good as anyone else's. The sheer marvel of it was almost enough to silence him.
"Well?" asked Kamal. "I think what we learn from this," said Hunapu, "is not that you can't intervene effectively in the past. After all, the interveners did prevent exactly what they set out to prevent. I've seen a lot more of Mesoamerican culture than any of you, and even though it's my own culture, my own people, anyway, I can promise you that a world ruled by the Tlaxcalans or the Mexica or even the Maya, for that matter, would never have given rise to the democratic and tolerant and scientific values that eventually emerged from European culture, despite all its bloody-handed arrogance toward other people."
"You can't say that," said Kamal. "The Europeans created the slave trade, and then gradually repudiated it. Who's to say that the Tlaxcalans wouldn't have repudiated human sacrifice? The Europeans conquered in the name of kings and queens, and by 5 centuries later, they had stripped those monarchs, where they survived at all, of every shred of power they once had wielded. The Tlaxcalans would have evolved as well.
But outside the Americas, wherever the Europeans conquered native culture survived," said Hunapu. "Altered, yes, but still recognizably itself. I think the Tlaxcalan conquest would have been more like the Roman conquest, leaving behind little trace of the ancient Gallic or Iberian cultures."
"This is all irrelevant," said Tagiri. "We aren't choosing between the interveners' history and our own. Whatever else we do, we can't restore their history, and we wouldn't want to. Whichever one was worse, ours or theirs, both were certainly terrible."
"And both," said Hassan, "led to some version of past watch, some future in which they were aware of their past and able to judge it."
"Yes," agreed Kamal rather nastily. "They both led to a time when meddlers with too much leisure on their hands decided to go back and reform the past to coincide with the values of the present. The dead are dead. Let's study them and learn from them."
"And help them if we can," said Tagiri, her voice thick with passion. "Kamal, all we learn from the interveners is that what they did was not enough, not that it shouldn't have been attempted at all."
"Not enough?
They were thinking only of the history they wanted to avoid, not of the history they would create. We must do better."
"But how can we?" asked Diko. "As soon as we act, as soon as we change something, we run the risk of removing ourselves from history. So we can only do one thing, as they did."
"They could only do one thing," said Tagiri, "because they sent a message.
But what if we sent a messenger?"
"Send a person?"
"We have found, by careful examination, what the technology of the interveners was. They didn't just send a message from their own time, because as soon as they started sending it, they would have destroyed themselves and the very instrument that was sending the message. Instead, they sent an object back in time, a holographic projector, with their entire message contained within it. They knew exactly where to place it and when to trigger it. We've found the machine. It worked perfectly. And then it released powerful acids that destroyed the circuitry, and after about an hour, when no one was nearby, it released a burst of heat that melted itself into a lump of slag, and then it exploded, scattering tiny molten fragments across several acres."
"You didn't tell us this," said Kamal.
"The team that is working on building a time machine has been aware of this for some time," said Tagiri. "They'll be publishing soon. What matters is this. They didn't just send a message. They sent an object. That was enough to change history, but not enough to shape it intelligently. We need to send back a messenger that can respond to circumstances, that can not only make one change, but keep on introducing more changes. That way we can do more than simply avoid one dreadful path. We can deliberately, carefully, create a new path that will make the rest of history infinitely better. Think of us as physicians to the past. It isn't enough just to give the patient one injection, one pill. We must keep the patient under our care for an extended period, adapting our treatment to the course of the disease.
You mean send someone into the past, said Kamal.
One person or several people, said Tagiri. Well, one person might get sick or have an accident or be killed. Sending several people would build some redundancy into our effort.
Then I must be one of the ones you send, said Kamal.
What? Cried Hassan. You? The one who believes we should make no intervention at all?
I never said that, said Kamal. I only said that it was stupid to intervene when you had no way of controlling the consequences. If you are sending a team back into the past, I want to be one of them, so I can make sure it goes properly, so I can make sure it's worth doing.
I think you have an inflated idea of your own powers of judgment, said Hassan crossly.
Absolutely, said Kamal. But I'll do it all the same.
If anyone goes at all, said Tagiri, we need to go over Hunapu's scenario and gather far more evidence.
Then whatever picture we emerge with, we must also plan what our changes will be. In the meantime, we have scientists working on our machine, but working with confidence because we've seen that a physical object can be pushed backward through time.
When all these projects are complete, when we have the power to travel back in time, when we know exactly what it is we're trying to accomplish, and when we know exactly how we intend to accomplish it, then we'll make our report public, and the decision whether to do it will be up to them. To everyone.
Columbus came home after dark, in the chilly night, weary to the bone, not from the walk home, for it wasn't that far, but rather from the endless questions and answers and arguments. There were times when he longed to simply say, Father Talavera, I have told you everything I can think of. I have no more answers. Make your report. But as the Franciscans of La Rábida had warned him, that would mean the end of his chances. Talavera's report would be devastating and thorough, and there would be no crack left through which he could escape with ships and crew and supplies for a voyage. There were even times when Columbus wanted to seize the patient, methodical, brilliant priest and say, Don't you know that I see exactly how impossible it looks to you? But God himself told me that I must sail west to reach the great kingdoms of the east, so my reasoning must be true, not because I have evidence, but because I have the word of God. Of course, he never succumbed to that temptation. While Columbus hoped that if he were ever charged with heresy, God might intervene and stop the priests from having him burned, he did not want to put God to the test on this. After all, God had told him to tell no one, and so he could hardly expect miraculous intervention if his own impatience put him in danger of the fire. So it was that the days and the weeks and the months stretched on behind him, and it seemed that the path ahead would have at least as many days and weeks and months, why not years, before at last Talavera said, Columbus seems to know more than he's telling, but we must make our report and have done with it. How many years? It made Columbus tired just to think of it. Will I be like Moses? Will I win consent to launch the fleet when I'm already so old that I will only be able to stand on the coast and watch them sail away? Will I never enter the promised land myself? No sooner had he laid his hand upon the door than it was flung open, and Beatrice greeted him with an embrace only slightly encumbered by her thick belly. Are you mad? Asked Columbus. It could have been anybody, and you opened the door without so much as asking who it was. But it was you, wasn't it? She said, kissing him. He reached behind him, shut the door, and then managed to extricate himself from her embrace long enough to bar it. You're doing no good for your own reputation, letting the whole street see that you wait for me in my rooms and greet me with kisses. You think the whole street doesn't already know? You think even the 2-year-olds don't already know that Beatrice has Cristobal's baby in her womb?
Then let me marry you, Beatrice, he said. You say that, Cristobal, only because you know that I'll say no. He protested, but in his heart he knew that she was right. He had promised Felipa that Diego would be his only heir, and so he could hardly marry Beatrice and make her child legitimate. Beyond that, though, was the reasoning that she always used, and it was correct. She recited it even now. You can't be burdened with a wife and child when the court moves to Salamanca in the spring. Besides which, right now you come before the court as a gentleman who consorted with nobility and royalty in Portugal. You are the widower of a woman of high birth. But marry me, and what are you? The husband of the cousin of Genovese merchants. That does not make you a gentleman. I think the Marquise de Moya wouldn't be as taken with you then, either. Ah, yes, his other affair of the heart, Isabella's good friend the Marquise. In vain he had explained to Beatrice that Isabella was so pious that she would not tolerate any hint that Columbus had dallied with her friend. Beatrice was convinced that Columbus slept with her regularly. She pretended elaborately that she didn't mind. The Marquise de Moya is a friend and a help to me because she has the ear of the queen and because she believes in my cause, said Columbus. But the only thing that I find beautiful about her is her name. De Moya? Teased Beatrice. Her Christian name, said Columbus. Beatrice, just like you. When I hear that name spoken, it fills me with love, but only for you. He rested his hand on her belly. I'm sorry to have burdened you like this. Your child is no burden to me, Cristobal. I can never make him legitimate. If I win titles and fortune, they'll belong to Felipa's San Diego. He will have the blood of Columbus in him, and he will have my love and the love you gave me as his heritage. Beatrice, said Columbus, what if I fail? What if there is no voyage and therefore no fortune and no titles? What is your baby then? The bastard son of a Genovese adventurer who tried to involve the crowned heads of Europe in a mad scheme to sail into the unknown quarters of the sea. But you won't fail, she said, comfortably nestling closer to him. God is with you. Is he? Thought Columbus. Or when I succumbed to your passion and joined you on your bed, did that sin, which I haven't the strength even now to forsake, deprive me of God's favor? Should I repudiate you now and repent of loving you in order to win his favor back? Or should I forsake my oath to Felipa and follow the dangerous course of marrying you? God is with you, she said again. God gave me to you. Marriage you must forsake for the sake of your great mission, but surely God does not mean you to be a priest, celibate and unloved. She had always talked this way, even at the start, so that at first he had wondered if God had given him at last someone to whom he could talk about his vision on the beach near Lagos. But no, she knew nothing of that. And yet her faith in the divine origin of his mission was strong and sustained him when he was at his most discouraged. You must eat, she said. You have to keep up your strength for your jousting with the priests. She was right, and he was hungry. But first he kissed her, because he knew that she needed to believe that she mattered more to him than anything, more than food, more than his cause. And as they kissed, he thought, if only I had been this careful of Felipa, if only I had spent the little time it would have taken to reassure her, she might not have despaired and died so young. Or if she died anyway, her life would have been happier until that day. It would have been so easy, but I didn't know. Is that what Beatrice is? My chance to amend my mistakes with Felipa, or simply a way to make new ones? Never mind. If God wanted to punish Columbus for his illegitimate coupling with Beatrice, then so be it. But if God still wanted him to pursue his mission to the West, despite his sins and his weaknesses, then Columbus would keep trying with all his strength to accomplish it. His sins were no worse than King Solomon's, and a far sight gentler than King David's, and God gave greatness to both of them. Dinner was delicious, and then they played together on the bed, and then he slept. It was the only happiness in these dark, cold days, and whether God approved or not, he was glad of it.
Tagiri brought Hunapu into the Columbus Project, putting him and Diko jointly in charge of developing a plan of action for intervention in the past. For an hour or two, Hunapu felt vindicated. He longed to go back to his old position, just long enough to say goodbye, seeing the envy on the faces of those who had despised his private project. A project that now would form the basis of the great Kemal's own work. But the glow of triumph soon passed, and then came dread. He would have to work among people who were used to a very high level of thought, of analysis. He would have to supervise people, he who had always been impossible to supervise. How could he possibly measure up? They would all find him lacking, those above him and those below. Diko was the one who brought him through these first days, being careful not to take over, but instead making sure that all decisions were jointly reached, that any time he needed her advice, even to know what the choices were, she prompted him only privately, where no one could see, so that the others wouldn't come to think of her as the real head of the intervention team. And soon enough, Hunapu began to feel more confident. And then the two of them really did lead together, often arguing over various points, but never making a decision until both agreed. No one but Hunapu and Diko themselves could have been surprised when, after several months together, each came to realize that their professional interdependence had turned to something much more intense and much more personal. It was maddening to Hunapu that he worked with Diko every day, that every day he grew more sure that she loved him as much as he loved her, and yet she refused any hint, any proposal, any outright plea that they extend their friendship beyond the corridors of Pastwatch and into one of the grass huts of Juba. "Why not?" he said. "Why not?" "I'm tired," she said. "We have too much to do." Normally he let this sort of answer stop him, but not today, not this time. "Everything is running smoothly in our project," he said. "We work together perfectly, and the team we've assembled is reliable and efficient. We go home every night at a reasonable hour. There is time, if only you took it, for us to eat a meal together, to sit and talk as a man and a woman." "There is no time for that," she said. "Why?" he demanded. "We're close to ready. Our project is. Kemal is still puttering along with his report on probable futures, and the machine is nowhere near done. We have plenty of time." The distress on her face usually would be enough to silence him, but not now. "This doesn't have to make you unhappy," he said. "Your mother and father work together just as we do, and yet they married and had a child." "Yes," she said, "but we will not." "Why not? What is it? That I'm so much smaller than you? I can't help the fact that Maya people are shorter than a Turco Dongatona." "You are so stupid, Hunapu," she said. "Father is shorter than mother, too. What kind of idiot do you think I am?" "Such an idiot that you're in love with me, just as I'm in love with you. Only for some insane reason you refuse to admit it. You refuse even to take a chance on us being happy together." To his surprise, tears came to her eyes. "I don't want to talk about this," she said. "But I do," he said. "You think you love me," she said. "I know I love you." "And you think I love you," she said. "I hope for that." "And maybe you're right," she said, "but there's something that both of us love more." "What?" "This," she said, indicating the room around them, filled with TrueSight 2s and tempo views and computers and desks and chairs. "People in Pastwatch love and live as human beings," he answered. "Not Pastwatch, Hunapu. Our project, the Columbus Project. We're going to succeed. We're going to assemble our team of three who will go back in time, and when they succeed, all of this will cease to be. Why should we marry and bring a child into the world in order to cause it to disappear in only a few more years?" "We don't know that," said Hunapu. "The mathematicians are still divided. Maybe all we create by intervening in the past is a fork in time, so that both futures continue to exist. You know that that is the least likely alternative. You know that the machine is being built according to the theory of meta-time.
Anything sent back in time is lifted out of the causal flow. It can no longer be affected by anything that happens to the time stream that originally brought it into existence, and when it enters the time stream at a different point, it becomes an uncaused causer. When we change the past, this present will disappear.
Both theories can explain the way the machine works, said Hunapu. So don't try to use your superior education in mathematics and time theory against me.
It doesn't matter anyway, said Deco, because even if our time continues to exist, I won't be in it.
There it was, the unspoken assumption that she would be one of the three who went back in time.
That's ludicrous, he said. A tall black woman going to live among the Taino?
A tall black woman with a detailed knowledge of events that still lie in the future for the people of the surrounding tribe, she said. I think I'll do well enough.
Your parents will never let you go.
My parents will do whatever it takes for this mission to succeed, she answered. I'm already far more qualified than anyone else. I'm in perfect health. I've been studying the languages I'll need for that aspect of the project, Spanish, Genovese, Latin, two Arawak dialects, one Carib dialect, and the Siboney language that is still used in Putukam's village because they think it's so holy. Who else can match that? And I know the plan inside and out, and all the thinking that went into it. Who can do better than I to adapt the plan if things don't go as expected?
So I will go, Hunapu. Mother and father will fight it for a while, and then they'll realize that I'm the best hope of success and they'll send me.
He said nothing. He knew that it was true. She laughed at him.
You hypocrite, she said. You've been doing just what I've been doing. You've designed the Mesoamerican part of the plan so that only you can possibly do it.
That too was true.
I'm as natural a choice as you are. More natural, because I'm a Maya. A Maya who's more than a foot taller than the Mayans and Zapotecs of the period, she retorted. I speak two Mayan dialects plus Nahuatl, Zapotec, Spanish, Portuguese, and both of the Tarascan dialects that matter.
And all your arguments apply to me as well.
Plus, I know all the technologies we're going to try to introduce, and the detailed personal histories of all the people we have to deal with. There is no choice but me.
I know it, said Deco. I knew it before you did. You don't have to persuade me.
Oh, he said.
You are a hypocrite, she said. And there was some emotion behind it.
You were all set to go yourself, and yet you expected me to stay behind. You had some foolish notion that we would marry and have a baby, and then I would stay behind on the off chance that there would be a future here while you went back and fulfilled your destiny.
No, he said, I never really thought of marriage.
Then what, Hunapu? Sneaking off to some sordid little rendezvous? I'm not your Beatrice, Hunapu. I have work of my own to do. And unlike the Europeans and apparently the Indies, I know that to mate with someone without marriage is a repudiation of the community, a refusal to take one's proper role within the society. I won't mate like an animal, Hunapu. When I marry, it will be as a human being, and it will not be in this time stream. If I marry at all, it will be in the past, because that's the only place where I have a future.
He listened, leaden at heart. The chance of our both living long enough to meet there is small, Deco.
And that, my friend, is why I refuse all your invitations to extend our friendship beyond these walls. There's no future for us.
Is the future, is the past, all that matters to you? Don't you have just a little bit of room for the present?
Again the tears flowed down her cheeks.
No, she said. He reached up and cleared her cheeks with his thumbs, then streaked his own cheeks with her tears. I will love no one but you, he said.
So you say now, she said. But I release you from that promise, and I forgive you already for the fact that you will love someone, and you will marry, and if we ever meet there, we will be friends and be glad to see each other, and we will not regret for one moment that we did not act foolishly now.
We will regret it, Deco, at least I will. I regret it now, and I will regret it then and always, because
No one that we meet in the past will understand what and who we really are, not the way we understand each other now. No one in the past will have shared our goals or worked as hard to help us achieve them as we've done for each other. No one will know you and love you as I do. And even if you're right and there's no future for us, I, for one, would rather face whatever future I do have